Your behavior right now is completely unacceptable.
Okay, I think you need to relax.
You don't you tell me to relax. You are flirting with everyone. You are chugging wine. You are sitting on a table. What is this? A party? And I thought I told you no funny business with Maya.
I don't know what that means.
Oh, yes, you do. Don't play dumb with me. I thought you were done experimenting.
You think everyone that's bi is experimenting? You don't know anything. You have zero gaydar.
Excuse me, kid. I lived through New York in the 80s. My gaydar is strong as a bull.
This is Snails and Oysters.
And welcome to Snails and Oysters, the bi-weekly, bi-coastal, bisexual movie podcast. I'm Nat Roberts.
And I'm Allie Rogers.
I was trying to really lean into the pride spirit with that intro and just have a wide dynamic range in my introduction.
Yeah, it was like very... I just felt like you gave 110%.
I really did, and I usually don't. I'm usually phoning this shit in.
No, you're usually at 101, but
it's just that Pride Month miracle that I had that extra 9% today.
There should be more like Pride Month mythology. Like, does someone
honestly, yeah,
come down your chimney and leave presents or something? I don't
know.
Yeah,
but they're all not safe for work. I agree. Like, we need like a children's book about Pride, starting some like fairy tale myths about it, where it's like, you know, if you act too straight during Pride Month, you'll get a lump of coal.
Oh my God, no!
If you wear khaki slacks during Pride Month,
no, you're about to be on fire. Fox News, Tucker Carlson alert. You're about to be on Fox. I'm feeling a little like bummed about Pride this month just because I feel like the political situation for queer people is getting darker
it's
and
not
darker.
Great. Yeah.
By the day.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of like, I'm not feeling particularly celebratory.
Yeah, well, there is one thing to celebrate, which is that cops won't be at San Francisco Pride this year.
Oh, yes. I read that.
Yeah.
I read that online.
That's the thing. They weren't even banned. They were just told they couldn't come in uniform, and the whole SFPD threw a temper tantrum, and the queer community was like, great, don't come.
Yeah, I saw someone who was like, weirdly, like, oh, this is like making me be in the closet. And I was like, it's not.
It's
like
really
that.
Not. Like, cops are the enemies of all people. Like, whether you get it or not, all marginalized people are oppressed by the police. But yeah. So that's a good one.
But anyway. Speaking of a movie with no cops, not a single cop in sight in this entire film.
That's true. This week's episode is on Shiva Baby.
I can take credit for this episode because I saw Shiva Baby and then I was like, nah, I think we should really do this movie. And
you realize I had heard of it before. Like, I know someone in this movie.
No, I know you'd heard of it, but I was like, Nat, how are we not doing this movie? Like,
that is true. You like, you campaigned to like do it on the show, and you do deserve credit for getting it on.
I'm just saying. I need our listeners to know, you know.
The people need to know the truth, which is that
I was
being lazy about watching this movie.
And aren't you glad? Aren't you glad?
I am. I really enjoyed this movie. So, like, full disclosure, I went to the same school as the director Emma Seligman, who I never met, and Rachel Sennett, the star of this movie. I knew Rachel slightly. We went to some of the same parties. I was not close with her by any stretch. Not because she isn't wonderful. I'm just specifying that because I don't want to sound like a star fucker. But I think I actually resisted watching this movie for a little bit because I was like, I've met this person. It feels weird that they're in a movie now. Like,
But that's what happens when you go to NYU Tisch.
Notice that's how I didn't happens. Say the name of my school.
I know, but the people need to know.
The people if you go need to NYU, know the truth.
if you go to NYU Tisch, all of a sudden, bam, someone you knew is starring in a very good movie.
A very good movie. It's an incredible movie.
Yeah.
So I am glad that you got me out of my funk and got me to watch it because it really is worthwhile.
Totally.
And that's the thing. And I am genuinely really happy for Rachel that she's doing so well, like insanely well already, because she's very funny and very talented. And in the few times I met her, she was very nice. She saw me at the party where I was the drunkest I've ever been in my life. Rachel, if you're listening, it was Philip Braun's kegger in Brooklyn. I doubt you would remember, but I Dakota Didi had to walk me home. Just shout out Dakota Didi.
Yeah, that's what's crazy is Rachel has like one of the funniest Twitters.
Oh yeah.
And so it was like, it feels like this movie coming out and her performance, it's like, wow, triple threat, you know?
Wait, what's the Twitter acting and...
Went to NYU Tisch.
Oh my God.
But at Twitter.
Not her stand-up, it's... just going to Tisch.
No. Okay, her stand-up and her Twitter, I think, in the same book.
Okay, but, comedy, comedy acting alumni.
NYU Tisch. That's the secret. That's the secret. I know it's like a little cabal. I know your little cabal. Anyways. Yeah.
Shh, you'll get me kicked out. definitely really, really excited to talk about this movie this week. It is like really, I think you said something about this in our conversation where it's just really refreshing to talk about like a non-genre contemporary film about bisexuality. You know?
Yeah, 100%. And it actually makes me really happy that I don't think we did this intentionally because we are kind of like
dumb
scheduling amateurs. I would say we're scheduling amateurs. But I actually love that it's such a current film that like is coinciding with our like Pride Month episode.
Yeah,
you know?
It is nice. And it also it's also perfect timing because the trailer for Rachel's next movie, Bodies, 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 released, I think, last month. And it comes out in August, but it's coming up. So if we were smarter at scheduling, maybe we would have timed it out for that. But
but we are who we are.
We are who we are. We're messy bisexuals. We don't know how to sit in chairs.
I literally didn't really even know what day it was today until Nat texted me like, are we still recording today? And I had to be like, oh, Jesus, it's Monday. And that's bisexuality.
That is bisexuality.
To me, that's my sexuality is not knowing what day of the week is.
Well, this whole movie is about messy bisexuals in their 20s. So let's get right to it.
Yes. Shiva Baby is a 2020, that's right, pandemic comedy written and directed by Emma Seligman. The film stars Rachel Sennett as Danielle, a bisexual Jewish woman who is, I think, in her last year of college and attends a Shiva with her family for someone that she doesn't know.
And at the Shiva, she's initially confronted by the overwhelming attention of this very insular Jewish community she grew up in. But the situation is further complicated by the presence of her high school ex-girlfriend, Maya, and her current sugar daddy, Max, and her sugar daddy's Shiksa princess wife, Kim.
And child.
Oh, yeah. The titular Shiva baby, Rosie, who does nothing but scream the entire movie.
Yeah, so I don't think we have to go too in depth on the plot. It's really just about this like claustrophobic social interaction where there's a lot of people in this room who care about Danielle, but this care can feel really suffocating. There's a lot of judgment from different people.
A lot of comments about weight gain, weight loss, and eating.
Yeah, it's very much a film about Danielle being confronted with the fact that this person who she's been in a very kind of just sexual exchange relationship is an actual person with an actual life.
With a whole other life.
With a whole other life. And like, and
a whole other wife.
Yeah, a whole other wife. And he's being confronted with the same. Their illusions of each other are kind of shattered throughout this day.
The anxiety and the tension just ratchets up throughout the day until Danielle finally has an emotional breakdown in the middle of the Shiva and is quickly like sort of rescued by her mother and hustled into her dad's van along with Maya and Max and Kim and their baby and her mom and a random old lady who they already agreed to give a ride to. But the film does end on a very tender note when Maya and Danielle start holding hands in the back seat.
The film debuted online at South by Southwest and then had its first screenings at TIFF, which is the Toronto International Film Festival.
Yep. Where actually my college friend Will Monahan used to work. Shout out to Will, who does not listen to the show.
Shout out, Will.
Now, obviously, anytime we're talking about a recent film, there's not much to go off of in terms of our personal relationships with it, because either we saw it in theaters or we saw it since. But Ali, you were the one who initially suggested doing Shiva Baby. How did you first hear about the movie?
I think I heard about it because back when I was more active on Twitter, I was like a huge, I think Rachel Sennett is so, so funny.
She is.
And yeah, and because I followed her, I was seeing all this buzz about this awesome role that she had and this great movie. And then when I found out that it was like about, you know, a bisexual young woman, I was just so excited. And I think like, I'm pretty sure that really early on, I remember reading that it was just set in one place. You know, it's really just takes place. There's technically two locations.
Right.
One is the
apartment at the beginning
right.
of the movie, and then the other is the Shiva.
Right. But really 95% of the film is the Shiva.
Yeah.
And I think I was really interested to see it just for that alone.
Totally. And it's set nearly all in real time. Like there's very little time jumps.
Yeah.
Very few time jumps throughout the movie.
Yeah. So I was really excited to see it. And I mean, we have to shout out the cover art for this film is so fun.
Oh, it's awesome.
I mean, it's Rachel Sennett in like a wedding dress covered
basically
in yeah bagels
yeah.
and locks and holding and really seductively looking at the camera with this bagel in her hand, and it's just like I think it's personally impossible to see this and not want to see this movie.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I agree. I as we mentioned in the intro, I also went to NYU around the same time as Rachel and Emma. But I was not very much in their circle. So I initially heard about this movie as, oh, did you hear Rachel's movie is getting really good reviews from all our like mutual college acquaintances?
Mm.
And I feel like I sort of held off on doing this movie on the show because I have that very slight connection to the people who actually made it. But honestly, I am so glad we did it. I'm so glad that we're talking about it because I think it's just a fantastic movie.
It's
honestly.
So good.
Yeah, let's get into it. I feel like every other episode, we start with the bisexuality and then go to the plot. And then the other half of the time, we start with the plot and then go to the bisexuality. I think we have to start with Danielle as a character all at once, because she really is the anchor of this movie.
Totally.
In a way that even most protagonists aren't, I would say.
Yeah, Danielle is just like a perfect encapsulation, I think, of the kind of anxious, directionless liberal arts student.
Yeah.
Especially young woman. There's an incredible scene with her parents and Max, her sugar daddy, where
yes.
like they're kind of, she's talking about what she majors in and Max says, I thought it was business. And her mom says, it's gender. And then she says, it's gender business. It's the business of gender, which is like truly so funny. I mean, this movie is so
oh, yeah.
funny. And
that's so true to like, they never explicitly say that Danielle goes to NYU, but there is the school at NYU called Gallatin that lets you design your major. And several characters comment on the fact that Danielle has invented her own major and no one knows what it is, including her, which is exactly what happened to every Gallatin student I knew.
Yeah. This character is so much a young woman trying on, I feel like, a bunch of different, like really trying to sort out who she is. And like, I feel like we see that in
yeah.
what she tells Max about herself. She's kind of told him that she's doing the sugar baby stuff to save money for law school. She doesn't really have money.
Right.
Throughout the film, we find out that it's actually her friend and ex, Maya, who's going to law school. She has no intention of going to law school. And also that
yep.
her parents, you know, provide.
Pay for all of her bills.
Right. So she's not like, she is not someone who is doing sex work out of like total financial necessity. You know, she's someone mm-hmm. who's doing it for other reasons. And I feel like the film gives us a lot of evidence to support that she's kind of doing it to just, she's really trying out who she is
mm-hmm.
and is trying out being independent. And this is one way for her to feel independent.
Absolutely. I think that's definitely what Seligman intended, because I read a lot of interviews to prepare for this episode, and in one for the Boston Hassle, she said, unfortunately, I feel like it's pretty universal. A lot of young women, young people, not having self-worth beyond sexual validation.
Yeah.
I think it's something that hindered my self-acceptance in college, since it's something I focused a lot of energy on. You know, she talks a lot.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, interviews about how Danielle is using the financial dynamic of being a sugar baby to sort of reaffirm her mm-hmm. power. You know, she talks about how the arc is sort of her realizing that sexual validation can give you a certain amount of self-worth, but ultimately not enough, which I think is a really interesting arc for a character, because I feel like I have seen a character like Danielle in so many movies, but never as a protagonist, usually as a joke character, even, you know, a secondary character in, call it a Coen Brothers movie or a Woody Allen movie, never as somebody who gets to tell their own stories to the extent that she does in this film.
Yeah. I do think she does, though, fit into the world of kind of characters we're more used to seeing on TV. I think she fits into the Fleabag
totally.
World. I think she fits into the girls' world, which are both like series that do deal with women negotiating their sexual independence. And I think what I love about, you know, what you just said about Seligman's intentions with the script is that it's a film that's so much about like the limits of the validation you can get from, you know, just being hot.
Yeah. Well, the limits of the validation you can get from outside. You know, I think we can talk later about, you know, the community that Danielle comes from and how it isn't reaffirming her in any way, even as it lavishes so much attention on her.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it is sort of like a film about like recognizing that you can't find validation outside yourself. Like you need to find your self-worth within yourself.
Yeah.
But not in like a hokey golden moment way, like in a raw emotional way.
Yeah. And I love that it's a film that is so free from like any kind of slut shaming at all. You know,
totally.
Like it's a film that's about really complicated choices that you might have judgments on yourself as a viewer, but it's not a film that's kind of saying like, yeah, sexual validation is wrong, and that's why, like,
yeah,
you know, you shouldn't be a sugar baby. It's just truly a movie about like a really complex person and a really complex
totally
situation that she's made herself, you know.
Yeah, I think the one instance of actual slut shaming is when Maya finds the sugar baby app on Danielle's phone and literally calls her a whore, but then later apologizes and shows curiosity, asking her why she does it and like accepting the answers that Danielle gives her rather than trying to place a value judgment on it. And in the context, it makes sense that she's upset with Danielle. We can get into the plot later, but I think it is interesting that is treated as the wrong thing to do rather than what Danielle is doing.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think it's true. You know, it's people engage in all sorts of sexual arrangements for their own reasons. Yeah. But I also think it's great that the movie doesn't let Danielle off the hook or celebrate, you know, her lifestyle. It just portrays it accurately, and it portrays the human costs of it.
Do you want to talk about Danielle and Maya?
Yes, actually, yeah. Yeah, I'd love to get into that, because I think it's a really great way of illustrating Danielle's bisexuality. Because I know, so Shiva Baby started as a short film that Seligman made as her senior thesis. But I believe, I have not seen the short, but I believe in the short, it's just Max is there at the Shiva, and that's the dynamic that's being explored. But Seligman always intended to introduce Maya, this ex-girlfriend, and explore Danielle's bisexuality more explicitly in a fuller version of the film. So I think Maya and Danielle's relationship and dynamic is so interesting because they are so similar in so many ways. They're both young, queer Jewish women from the same community. I think at one point Maya even says, like, we do look a lot alike. It's pretty fucked up.
Yeah, because they're having this incredible conversation with Max, who's kind of teasing them about what good friends and how much fun they must have had at prom, not realizing that they went to prom as a couple.
Together.
Yeah, not just as two friends going.
Oh, couldn't get a date. We went together. Nope. And then Maya just goes, yeah, and then we totally fucked.
It's so, again, an incredible, hilarious moment.
Yeah. In the interview, Seligman talked about how if you want to have a bisexual character in your movie, you either have to explicitly say they're bisexual or give them two love interests. And since film is a visual medium, the love interest route is a little more in line with the way film works. And so I think it's really interesting that the male love interest she chose is a sugar daddy, while the female love interest she chose is a past girlfriend, yeah. a high school girlfriend, somebody who really knows her well and has a romantic connection with her rather than just a sexual one.
I think it's so interesting because they're such different people, and the script does such a good job of showing that, you know, where... Danielle is kind of anxious, unsure of what she wants to do with her life, unsure of what her major is. Is it gender of business or business gender?
Or comedy or entertainment.
Or comedy or activism.
Or gender comedy. Yeah.
So while she's dealing with that, you know, Maya at one point is asked, oh, are you also in the arts? And she says, oh, God, no, I'm going to law school. And like, it's really implied that I think Danielle is in her last year of college and Maya as well. And so she's about to go to law school. And just like the level of focus you have to have as an undergraduate to then immediately go into graduate school. Like it really is a type of focused person. And Maya just has...
Yeah.
Her shit together a little bit. And I think that is part of where her judgment comes from.
Yeah.
When she does lash out and call Danielle a whore, it's partially because she's kind of a more rigid, focused person who knows what she wants. She feels like she knows right and wrong. She knows the right path for her. And she's like a little bit judgmental as a result. But the other thing that I love about their dynamic is that Danielle can't hide from Maya.
Yeah.
So you have this character who's a very, like, I think a lot of Rachel Sennett's performance is so internal and you're trying to figure out how she feels about everything that's going on. And what's so great is that Maya is the person who just immediately calls her out on her bullshit because they've been like raised together, you know? And I think the other thing that's so wonderful is the fact that they're exes, but also they're in this community. So they're not exes who can fully extricate each other.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to have to find a way to coexist.
Exactly. Yeah. I love the scene with the two of them. There's a scene where the two of them go outside to smoke while Maya's smoking and Danielle is just there to catch her breath after yet another anxious encounter.
Yeah.
You know, the two of them talk and they're very aggressively telling each other how much they miss each other, which.
Yeah, it's so good.
It's so good. And it's so funny because watching this movie, I felt like I just went home with one of my college friends.
Totally.
Like I just went home to accompany them to a Shiva.
Yeah.
I just knew so many people who talk like them, act like them, live like them, both the focused and the unfocused variety. So for me, this was it was a similar experience in many ways, actually, to Lady Bird, which I know I don't think I've seen anyone compare this movie to. But it feels like getting access to the life of someone I've already known.
Hmm.
Like with Lady Bird, it was my sisters and my mother. Hmm. With this movie, it's a lot of my college friends.
Hmm. Also, we should say that Maya and Danielle kiss. They have this incredible kiss. So that's another thing I love about this movie is some of the movies we discuss on the podcast – they're bisexual, but you don't always like see encounters with two or more genders in the same movie. You might know about someone's past or like
implied or canonical, you know, the Disney approach. Disney. Canonically they're bi, but don't tell anyone outside the US.
Yeah. I love their dynamic. And I think it's the way that she and Maya just know each other so well is at such a like contrast with her and Max. Who
don't know each other at all.
They only know each other in terms of what they've told each other. And it turns out they haven't told each other much of the truth at all.
I think they've just lied entirely to each other. And I think if you want to switch gears and talk about Danielle and Max for a minute, I'd love to, because I think their relationship is sort of, if Danielle and Maya are one extreme of familiarity, where they are almost too familiar with each other to date. Then Max and Danielle are the opposite extreme where they have been fucking each other, but they don't know each other at all. They have been wearing masks or costumes and role playing the people they wish they were, or maybe not even wish is too strong a word, but they have a dissatisfied part of themselves that
they're like acting out.
Exactly. And it's interesting to see the personas that the two of them choose, where Max chooses to portray himself as like a young, successful, single guy living it up in Manhattan, while Danielle chooses to portray herself as a super focused, highly accomplished, but poor law student. You know, it's they choose to play the opposite of who they are in real life, where Max is a husband whose wife makes more money than him. In fact, makes all of the money in their family.
Yeah, I think that's.
And then, you know, Danielle, as we've discussed, is absolutely not have her shit together.
Yeah. And it's funny because the masks they're wearing, the people they're kind of pretending to be, I think, as we've already touched on with Danielle, but also with Max, have to do with kind of reasserting power where they might feel a little powerless or disempowered. I think with Max, there's this implication that he's a bit embarrassed by the fact that his wife is the breadwinner, or if not embarrassed, there's like, you know, a part of his masculinity that it's toxic masculinity. Yeah. It's like wounded. And like, but like in the moments where he gets to pay for sex, that feels financially like he's in control and he's the big dog. And we've already touched on kind of Danielle, the power that she might feel and just feeling like validated.
Yeah.
But
that, that her sexuality is so powerful, someone will pay for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing. I've known people, and I won't specify how I know them, but because of just privacy, I have known people who are involved in like financial dominatrix relationships or sugar baby relationships, things like that. And it's really fascinating to see the way that money in a capitalist society translates as a proxy for power in sexual relationships. And so, you know, with a financial dominatrix, it's more about giving someone control over your money as a way of dominating you and feeling taken care of. Like somebody else is just telling you what to do with this money. Whereas with sugar babies, it's very much about like, ah, yes, I am in control of this relationship because money is changing hands. And that's for both of them.
Yeah.
I can definitely see why Seligman was drawn to this topic. Even, you know, this film is clearly semi-autobiographical in terms of setting and character, but I don't believe Seligman herself ever participated in sugar baby culture. She just knew a lot of people at NYU, like I did, who did it.
Right. That's so interesting. Oh, so you know what they're doing? They're kind of cosplaying.
Totally.
As, you know, as just slightly different versions of themselves to kind of get something out, get some self-esteem from that.
Well, I was going to say it's very Esther Perel, very like we desire in bed what we feel is absent from our outside lives, or we want in bed what we would protest against in the streets in the real world. Mm.
Yeah. What do you think Danielle and Max think of each other when they're unmasked? Because they're not just unmasked because they know they suddenly, you know, Danielle suddenly learns that he has a wife and a baby, and he suddenly learns she's not in law school. But it's also like suddenly they're given this full context of this is who I am in this community.
Right. And revealed that they're in the same community.
Yes.
Even if like slightly tangentially, but it's still connected.
Yeah.
I find their initial interactions so fascinating. Like there's a great moment where they first see each other and she's talking to her mom and she sees Max across the room and he sees her as he's talking to her dad, who he used to work for. And it's like the Always Sunny in Philadelphia meme where they're just staring at each other from across the restaurant. Like, I hate to just reference a meme, but that is the only thing I could think of because they're just like losing their shit internally as they stare at each other from across this room. But, you know, I think the script does a great job of getting the exposition out of the way quickly and just being like, he has a wife, she's not in law school, now fights. So we get to see these great interactions where they're like needling each other, but also trying to seduce each other at the same time to establish that even though you know a little more about me, you still want me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that I think there's a really pivotal moment in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Where she follows him to the bathroom and tries to give him a blowjob. And
he very nearly takes it. He very nearly does.
I actually had to go back and rewatch that scene because it's so well edited in terms of making you think that it's going to happen that I was like, wait, did it actually happen?
And it just cut away. Yeah. And what's so great is that when she's talking to her mom after being – quote unquote introduced to Max, she says, what? It's not like I'm going to blow him in the bathroom.
Hilarious line. Incredible.
Yeah. That scene is really interesting though, because their relationship has been treated as such a joke throughout the movie, honestly. But that's the scene where we feel the stakes of his infidelity and her sex work the most vividly, because suddenly these two characters who have mostly comedic interactions are having like a very sexual and very it's interesting. I heard Seligman describe this movie as neurotica, which I
think... Oh my God, it 100% is Neurotica. That's an incredible, incredible, incredible
absolutely.
Word.
I want to see so many more Neurotica films.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think that scene personifies that genre classification the best because it is... Like, you feel the sexual tension between them, but you are not turned on in the slightest by the scene because you're just freaking out about what could happen if they actually go through with this.
100%.
I feel like sort of the third piece of the puzzle here is Danny's parents, played by Polly Draper and the legendary Fred Melamedes. Just Cy Abelman coming in again. He basically is playing Cy Abelman, too.
Wait, who's Cy Abelman?
You don't know Cy Abelman. He's Fred Melamed played this character in the Coen Brothers' A Serious Man.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
You should see it because Seligman cited it as a source of inspiration for this movie because it's also very much about Ashkenazi Jewish culture in America.
Really?
But Cy Abelman has become this meme because he basically cuckolds the main character in that movie, then dies, and then the main character is forced to pay for his funeral.
Oh my God, hilarious.
It's insane. But particularly, I think Danny's relationship with her mother, Debbie, is very revealing of how she became the person she is, how she became this wonderfully messy bisexual because her mother, not to keep citing interviews, I feel like I did my research for once and now I can't help but show off. But Seligman talked about the Jewish mother archetype. You know, this nagging but loving mother who like puts so much pressure on her kid and like, you know, talks about what they're eating, they're losing weight, who they're sleeping with, who they're not sleeping with, all of this stuff. And she really wanted to take that archetype and flesh it out, not change it, but flesh it out.
Hmm.
I think she sort of said that was her intent with the whole movie, is to flesh out the tropes of Jewish American comedy.
That's so interesting.
She said like people watch Maisel, people watch Curb, and they feel like they know these people, but do they really?
I feel like you might be more familiar with the tropes in which he's trying to do, just because you're a little bit more of a film buff. You went to NYU.
Did I mention?
So what do you think of, like, how does she blow that up?
I think she does a wonderful job of it because, like I said, she doesn't change a thing. You know, like Debbie is, from the moment she's on screen to her final moment on screen, she is complaining, she's kvetching, she's nagging her daughter and her husband. She's like saying under her breath, I'm going to kill you for like various social faux pas. But within that, she's given these moments of real tenderness and depth and perception that I think that character is rarely given. You know, she has this wonderful moment when Danielle gets hot coffee spilled on her and she's like blotting it out with like the religious ablution water. I am a Gentile. I have no idea what the proper terminology is beyond Shiva, but this like basically holy water she's using to wipe off Danielle's shirt. But also like Danny sort of hints at this anxiety she's been feeling all day and this pressure she feels she's under, and her mom, suddenly her interrogative quality is a good quality because she's like, hey, talk to me, tell me what you're feeling, tell me what you're going through.
Yeah.
Are you feeling this? Are you feeling that? Like, she actually gets Danny to talk a little bit.
Yeah.
And then of course later when Danny has this sort of emotional episode in the Shiva, she goes damage control and just is protecting her daughter. But she like sits down beside her and is like, everyone here loves you.
Yeah.
And it's just this really great moment where you get the, you know, I think with a comedic character like that, where sort of the joke is that they nag or they kvetch, you can start to lose sight of why someone would want to have a relationship with them.
Mm.
What I think Shiva Baby does so well is showing the full dimensionality of this mother-daughter dynamic, and you get why Danny is still in touch with her mother and is so honest with her mother and is still like, no, I'm bi, mom. You just think everybody who's bi is experimenting. You know, it just... I'm sorry, I went on way too long about this, but I just think it's a fascinating dynamic.
No, and I want to like stop on that like everyone here loves you thing.
Yeah.
Because I think that what her relationship with her parents shows, but also with the larger community that's portrayed, is just that like it can be so such an intense
experience to be a young person surrounded by people who love you, trying to figure out your life. And, yeah. and I say that fully aware that also that is like a huge privilege to have that, but that also there's so much stress and anxiety. I mean, I was just thinking the other day about what a relief it is that people don't ask me anymore what I'm going to be when I grow up. And I think a lot of times people look at that as like sad that people might look at you as a more finished product, but there's people's own hangups.
Yeah.
Adults, the hangups and the dreams and the like failures of adults can really get projected on young people as they're trying to figure out their own life. And it's really interesting that I feel like this is very much a film about like, I do think everyone in that room loves her, but not everyone is doing the best way of expressing it. You know, like maybe not. No comments about weight.
Yeah,
you know?
Maybe less comments about, oh, you've lost so much weight. Have you eaten enough?
Well, it's kind of about like the double-edged sword sometimes mm-hmm. of what love and care can look like when it's can get a little, I don't know, toxic or overbearing, or there's just a double-edged sword, you know?
I'm going to whip out one of my quotes. I think Seligman expressed exactly the words you're looking for, which is, I hope other people understand that it feels like a horror movie sometimes to be a young woman.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%, 100%.
Now, that's actually, I think, a great segue into one of the major themes of the movie that I think mm-hmm. is particularly well executed, which is anxiety. You know, Danielle is clearly an anxious character, even though she never says, oh, by the way, remember I have an anxiety disorder? And the film is shot on an anamorphic lens, which sort of curbs and denatures the frame at the corners, which really puts us into her headspace of anxiety. Like a lot of the cinematic language roots us in her experience of this situation, which is to say one driven by anxiety. And the score specifically, you know, Seligman intended, the composer intended, and critics definitely picked up on that the score of this movie sounds like a horror movie score. It's mostly violins.
Yeah.
It's mostly strings. It's very ba-dunk, ba-dunk, ba-dunk. I actually had to pause the movie multiple times during my viewing because I just needed to stand up and walk out of the room. Mm-hmm. Like I was too overwrought to continue to sit through this situation without screaming, get out of there. Don't open the door.
Yeah.
What did you think of the film's portrait of anxiety and its relationship to anxiety?
I thought it was really, really good. I think it doesn't just show the horror of being a young woman, but also the horror of being inside any family sometimes. I think sometimes family can just feel so close that it's oppressive.
Yeah.
Or just you can feel so horribly misunderstood by these people who are supposed to, you know, be your closest.
Be on your side.
Yeah, be on your side. And it can be such a struggle to self-define, you know, if you're not fitting into the image that your various family, friends, community might want for you. And I really loved the portrayal of the way that that can just create so much anxiety, especially when you're in a room with someone like Maya, an ex who knows you so well, or your mother, where like, you can't really hide anything.
Yeah.
And she's not good at like, she's kind of like,
she has no
so
poker
wound
face.
Up.
Yeah.
She has no poker face and she's so wound up and so spun up that like her kind of every twitch is being surveilled.
Yeah.
You know,
surveillance.
It feels like, honestly, surveillance yeah. feels like a huge, like, just surveillance by others. There's actually a few moments where we hear other people at the Shiva talking about Danielle or talking about Maya. And yeah. you just get this sense of like, oof, like they yeah. can't hide, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that definitely overlaps with one of the other broad themes of the film, so to speak, which is food and body image, because so much of the surveillance of the young women in this community is about their weight, and not necessarily in the way that you might expect. Like, characters aren't being criticized for being overweight. They're being interrogated about their weight and their relationship with food. And have they eaten today? What are they eating most of the time? Usually it's characters commenting on weight lost and like clutching pearls about it. Like, are you anorexic? Are you like, what's going on?
Yeah. Are you okay?
Food is also used as sort of a visual metaphor for Danielle's heightened anxiety throughout the day, where she keeps going to eat and being invented and then snatching food and eating it surreptitiously. And like, I think after her kiss with Maya, she like grabs a random person's cookie off a plate and just stuffs it into her mouth because she's so wound up. She can't take it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love the way food is like used in this movie. And it's a great way to signal you know, was this conversation stressful?
Yeah.
Or too much? Or was this conversation satisfactory? Or do you just have to make a show of getting food? One of the really tense conversations between Maya, Danielle, and Max, I think, happens in front of a...
in front of the buffet.
The buffet, yeah. And it's just like... so, and they're just talking, you know, so loudly about, oh yeah, we fucked on prom night. Yeah, you know,
like an old man buffet. Walks away from them afterwards.
He's like, I'm just trying to get a snack.
I just want my bagel with lox.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. That the particular foods being presented are so specific to like specifically reformed Ashkenazi Jewish culture in the United States. Obviously bagel with lox, but also just like every little thing, the salads, the arugula, the all of the foods being referenced are so culturally specific and such representations of this insular community that the characters are from. Obviously, neither of us are Jewish, so
I can't comment on it because I only really started to love lox bagels 3 years ago. You know, like before that, I was like, you put a fish on a bagel. And luckily, I worked for a year above the latest location of Russ and Daughters. And it was incredible.
Oh, that sounds like a dream. I bring up the cultural specificity of the food because obviously the, you know, this film is very rooted in a bisexual identity, but also in a Jewish identity.
Yeah.
Seligman herself is a reformed Ashkenazi Jew and a bisexual young woman. And so obviously the character draws on that. What's interesting though, is that Rachel Sennett is neither.
Oh, really?
She's, yeah, which actually got quite a bit of commentary, and I'm curious about your take on it because, you know, it's again, one of these quotes I found was Seligman saying, like, Rachel told me that someone stopped her on the street and was like, I love it. You're doing Jewish comedy, but you're not Jewish. And Rachel was like, what does that mean? And I said, I think they just mean you're anxious. But, you know, I did see a few, you know, people criticizing like, oh, because this was part of a contemporary released around the same time that people were talking about the boundaries of who, which actors can play what parts. And so, you know, is it acceptable for a non-queer actor to play a queer part? Is it acceptable for a non-Jewish actor to play a Jewish part? I'm curious. We've never really discussed that before. Sorry to just sort of drop it on you, but what do you think?
That's trying to get me canceled. No, I'm not a big believer that cancel culture is particularly real. Oh, sorry, my dog. I personally think these questions are incredibly complicated, and I will be the first. Yeah. I'll be the first to say that I'm probably more likely to get it wrong than get it right. I'm not Jewish, so
yeah.
That's. I'm incredibly, incredibly white.
I think, given that it's the two of us having this conversation, I think we can focus on the queer element of it. Sorry, I interrupted just as you were about to say something. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, I'm just not a big, I think it's very complicated. I guess personally, from like my identity standpoint, I don't really have a problem with a straight person playing a queer role. Although I would say it depends on the role. In this particular film, I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
I think particularly women, I think because, I don't know, there's just something about it that offends me less, maybe because I am a woman, but I also think because there's a lot of like, I don't know, it just bothers me less and I probably can't verbalize it. But I don't have an issue with it. I think it depends on the film. I think it depends on the actor. Obviously, if an actor has been homophobic, they should not be playing queer roles.
Yeah.
I think there's lots of reasons people can be angry, but I'm not someone who wants to be really strict about like making sure someone checks all the boxes of the role that they're portraying.
I tend to agree. Similar to you, I can only really comment on the queer element of this question. Like, I don't think unless people are actually up in arms about white chicks, I don't think there's much conversation to be had about my racial identity. But as for straight actors playing queer characters, we've come to this refrain a few times, but I think it is sort of about the pattern rather than the specific example. And so, yes, there are plenty of straight actors who have played queer characters. There are also a lot of queer actors who have played straight characters. And so as a rule, I don't think it's a problem. I think when there's a particular trend, it can become problematic. Like, yeah. I think the best most recent example is the trend of cis actors portraying trans characters to get awards.
Yeah.
You know, that's been going on since the 90s, really. And it's picked up steam with things like Dallas Buyers Club and Transparent. And we can get into the nitty gritty of the particular dimensions of each of those parts, but it's not really about any one of those parts. It's about the trend and about the exclusion of trans actors from those roles.
Right. It's really about the opportunities that are being given to actors from marginalized backgrounds.
Yeah.
And I think it's really about, well, if the only roles that were really even looked at is like for our own identity, yeah. when a straight person takes it or when a cis person takes it, that is really bad for a yeah. community. And I do agree.
And at the same time, I think it's also about authenticity, where
yeah.
if a role is written and portrayed authentically, like I would say this one is, like, then I have fewer concerns. And I think that's why it's so important to talk about diversity and representation behind the camera as well as in front.
Yeah.
You know, I think that a lot of this film works because Seligman is a 26-year-old Jewish bisexual woman. And if this movie was written by a 45-year-old straight man, it would read like it. And even if you cast a 20-something bisexual Jewish woman in the part, it might not feel as authentic because the authorial voice isn't there.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I like you, I think it's complicated. And I think it has a lot to do with power.
Yeah.
And who has power on set, who has power over the story, rather than
who's the sugar daddy, who's the sugar
exactly,
baby.
Exactly. Which studio executive is, you know. And in this particular instance, it's so clear that Seligman had final creative control. The film was very untraditionally financed, you know, very much driven by small donations and loans and grants and all of these little things collated together. So there was never a studio who had like a real say over how anything could be portrayed.
Oh, thank God.
Right?
More like this. More
yeah,
like
seriously.
This.
that's the thing. Yeah.
I will say that like, there is one dynamic in the film that I feel like, because I'm not Jewish, I don't really fully understand the dynamic. Mm-hmm. And that's the dynamic between the Shiksa princess, Kim, and just what she kind of represents in the film and the tension, particularly between her and Danielle. A lot of the tension just seems to derive from the fact that Kim is a bit suspicious, or perhaps that Danielle, it's hard to tell.
Yeah.
And I think this is really smart. It's hard to tell. Is Kim actually onto the affair, or is Danielle's anxiety
projecting that onto her?
Projecting it. Yeah. And I love how ambiguous that is.
It is.
I would say that that feels like a really fraught element to the film that I'm just like, I don't have full access to what it is. And all our Jewish listeners can tell us.
Yeah, exactly. Please call in and tell us more. I'm familiar with the term shiksa as like the idea of like a non-Jewish woman who tempts Jewish men away from women of their faith. And it's...
I am too, but pretty much primarily from the song Shiksa Goddess, which I think is from...
The last 5 years?
Yeah, the last five
oh,
years.
Oh God, that fucking... anyway.
I know.
I've only seen the movie and the movie is bad. But I, yeah, like that, my familiarity extends as far as yours does. I did find something interesting in interviews, which is that the actress playing Kim, Diana Agron, is Jewish.
That's so
funny. Rachel Sennett is not, but they don't look it. And that is actually used as sort of a meta joke, if you know that watching the film, because Agron is somebody who is not perceived as Jewish, but is, and Sennett is someone who's perceived as Jewish, but is not. And so I think a more qualified commentator could probably get into the various dynamics at play with a convert or a non-Jew attending what is ostensibly a religious ceremony, even though it has the vibe of a family reunion.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of comments are made about like, oh, who brings a baby to a Shiva? Doesn't she understand this? She pronounced it arugula, not rugula. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it's interesting that Kim is both put on a pedestal as this uber successful businesswoman.
Girl boss.
Super hot girl boss. With a adorable bouncing baby, but also like rejected as the outsider, as the shiksa.
Yeah, she's kind of taken down a peg for not knowing totally the etiquette and like
totally.
The pronunciation. And it's kind of a way to balance out the power dynamic there.
Yeah,
you know?
It's sort of like she's the superior outsider and Danielle is the inferior insider.
Insider,
while
yeah.
Maya is the superior insider.
Insider.
And there is no inferior outsider, though that would be an interesting yeah. completion of the Punnett square.
Yes, yes.
The rivalry between the two of them through illusion, through implication, through suspicion is really fascinating because, again, I think this is the sort of story that we've often seen from the man's perspective in something like that bastard Woody Allen's films. Or from the wife's perspective, and like she's got to find the other woman or get revenge on her husband. But to see it from the perspective of the unwitting accomplice of this infidelity is really interesting.
You mean Daniela's the unwitting accomplice?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Because she doesn't know he's married.
Well, yeah. Well, and Kim is also an unwitting accomplice because she is the breadwinner.
Right. She's funding this.
It's implied, that she is paying for it.
Not even implied. I think when Max breaks off their relationship, Danielle says, yeah, we better stop before your wife runs out of money.
Yeah.
Brutal.
Brutal line.
Before we move on, I really, it's weird because I know her, but I have to shout out Rachel Sennett's performance. It's just incredible. She starred in the original short film in the same part, and she's actually the one who got Seligman to think about making this as a feature. And there were a lot of times where
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Seligman was encouraged to recast the part with somebody more recognizable, but she refused to because Sennett was so involved. Mm. And I think it shows. Like, I think the performance is so thorough.
Yeah.
You know, it's partly a meeting of the minds because this is very much Sennett's comedy persona.
Mm.
But it's also just she realistically builds up this anxiety throughout the film so that you totally believe every decision she makes. Yeah. It's just phenomenal.
It's really, really good. Yeah. And that's a lot to carry. Totally. You know, that's the camera is on her face, like so tight for so much of the film. And that's, it's so good.
It is.
I think the last thing I want to say before we potentially move to the game is just that one of the reasons I was so excited to watch this film is that we've watched some recent films, for sure. But it's funny, even watching a film like Brokeback Mountain, relatively recent, still feels really old and queer time.
Yeah.
You know, in the time of sexuality and gender and the way it evolves in our culture, how we talk about it, how accepted it is. I was just so excited to watch a film from 2020.
Yeah.
It just felt like a portrayal of bisexuality and like the funny conversation she and her mom have that you brought up earlier, and the way that she and her friend, like, I think it felt really fresh and nice to see a contemporary portrayal of a young bisexual woman.
I was really excited to talk about it too. Before we end, I'd like to talk about the end of the movie because it's such a beautiful scene of they're finally leaving the Shiva and everyone gets in the same car, you know, through by hook or by crook. Everyone is convinced to get in this car and accept a ride from her dad, Joel, who's just the bumbling, lovable, like super confident, even though he has no idea what's going on sort of guy. And it just the ending reminded me so much. And this is such a pretentious sentence I'm about to say. But the ending reminded me so much of the ending of Fellini's 8½.
Haven't seen it, but love that.
Fair enough. I was going to ask. And for our listeners who aren't familiar, it's sort of the similar sentiment where it's this big circus scene with all of the characters present and participating. And it just both scenes give me this big sentiment of this is your life. Even the especially the parts you're not proud of. This is your life. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. I agree. I loved the end because I think the stakes feel so high for parts of the movie in terms of, you know, what does this mean for Max
and his marriage and
his family? What does this mean for this young woman who might be like wrapped up in this very adult drama? And what does this mean for her and Maya who have like incredible chemistry? And yeah, I loved that they're all put together in this van because to me, it's kind of about how we kind of are all going to the same place no matter what.
Yeah.
You know, no matter like the scandalous shit we do, eventually we all have to like get in the car and drive somewhere. Yeah. Or, you know, more metaphorically,
die.
We all die, you know? And it, to me, it just kind of was this moment of like, no matter how dramatic interpersonal relationships might be, especially if you're in a community together, you have to find a way to come to some kind of peace with your interpersonal
shit.
Yeah, I'm like struggling for words because I don't want to call it drama.
Tension.
That makes it sound frivolous.
Struggle. Yeah.
Struggle. Yeah, and like it's a struggle that like, you know, it's a story that I don't know the statistics, but like stories of infidelity and things like that are just like classic stories in literature and film. And just like, I love that this film ends with just this banality of the van.
That's what I was just thinking. It's
like exquisitely banal.
Yeah. It like undercuts without undercutting, like without robbing it of the importance. It just sort of, it's this reminder of, and tomorrow you'll have to do the same thing all over again. So now that we're ending on the ending, let's play our traditional game of Marry, Fuck, Kill, which feels somehow appropriate to this episode. Like similar to the Y Tu Mama Tambien episode, this feels like something the characters themselves would play. Now for our three bachelors, what do you say? I think the obvious one, and I am down to do it if we can do something else if you prefer, but I think the obvious is Danielle, Maya, and Max.
I think we shouldn't do Danielle because you went to school with her.
True, that would be weird.
I think we should do Maya, Max, Kim.
Yeah, I like that better. I like that better anyway. Because then we're making the same decision that Danielle has to, basically.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, I've already got mine.
Same.
I would marry Maya because she's going places, but she's not like a tight ass about it.
Yep.
I would fuck Kim because she's beautiful. Nothing more complicated than that. And honestly, like, even though she has an antagonistic role in the story, she seems like a chill person.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, she tries to give Danielle a job.
Yeah.
And then, I would kill Max. You know, fuck him. he's such a fucking, I get why Danielle is interested in him, but fuck him.
Okay, we're exactly on the same page. I want to marry Maya because she's going to take care of me and my like weird art shit with her nice lawyer salary. And she's so grounded.
And I mean, speaking of good performances, Molly Gordon, she also was incredible. A standout in Booksmart. Really great. Yeah. Really great performance.
So good. Yes, I would also fuck Kim because she is just a girl boss, you know? And I want to see that and I would kill Max because he's fucking annoying and needs to figure his shit out and stop being a loser.
He needs to shit or get off the pot, you know? You want to be a stay-at-home dad? Be a stay-at-home dad. You don't want to do that?
Don't do that.
Get a job, hippie!
Yeah, get a job, hippie.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Snails and Oysters. I, of course, am Nat Roberts.
And I'm Allie Rogers.
And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends, post about it on social media, subscribe, like, review, whatever your platform of choice lets you do to our show, do it to us, daddy.
Yes. And thank you to Billy Libby for our beautiful theme music and Abby Austin for our perfect cover art.
You can find both their social media handles in the episode description, along with Allie's and my own. And of course, Snails and Oysters is at Snails Oysters on Twitter. Shoot us a message if you like the show, hate the show, have ideas for future episodes, or think that we really screwed up this week's Marry, Fuck, Kill.
And if you really like the show and you're just like
really, really,
you really like it and you're like, you know what? I've got too much cash lying around.
If you want to be our sugar daddy.
Yeah, if you want to be our monthly sugar daddy, we are an extremely good deal. $5 a month, one level on Patreon. It's patreon.com/snailsoysters. And you get film reviews from Nat. And you also get one bonus episode a month, which is just Nat and I talking about. We're going through our 50 favorite movies, alternating one by one. And, you know, inflation, it's getting tough out there. So help a girl out.
Yeah. I live in LA. I gotta pay for gas money, man.
Anyway. Dude, the gas out here is bananas.
Oil prices are dropping and they're gouging. Anyway, can you tell that we recorded this episode in March? But whether or not you help fund my gas bill for the month, we want to thank you
for being a bye ally.